Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Pine Valley has a higher wildfire risk than 99% of the U.S. Here's how it's adapting. A sculptor wants his grand Utah arch to unify Americans. The surprised neighborhood wants to stop it. And Davis County formally rebukes a commissioner over claims of egregious workplace behavior. Joining me today on the program are Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. We also have State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. And reporter Tony Semerad joins us. Tony, thanks.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for being with us. So we'll start with Brooke. Interesting story, of course, wildfires burning in Utah and indeed across the West. So, Brooke, you looked at Pine Valley, which burned, I think, last year, right?
Yeah, so there was a wildfire in Pine Valley, which is about 35 miles north of St. George last summer.
Tell me about that, the Forsyth Fire. That was a pretty big fire.
Yeah, I mean, it was, around 16,000 acres, which is quite a bit smaller than, you know, some of these massive 90 to 100,000 acre wildfires we're seeing in Utah this summer. But what was pretty significant about this one is it did burn 13 homes in the town of Pine Valley. And this is just a really popular recreation area for Southwest Utah and even Nevada residents will go here because it's kind of one of the few higher elevation spots near very hot St. George area. So it's a popular place. Homes burnt down. That's kind of why this fire received so much attention, even though it was smaller than some of these really large ones we're seeing this year.
You know, firefighters experience PTSD, and that Pine Valley Recreation Area, that's not going to be reopened for a few years.
Yeah, so firefighters, you know, experience PTSD. There's a local volunteer fire department in Pine Valley, and they were the first on the scene. Two of those firefighters lost their homes in the fire. And then the forest that, you know, people who live there kind of see as an extension of their backyard is still pretty damaged. Lots of burnt trees that are safety hazards that the Forest Service is working on logging. There were also significant flash floods in October when we had those heavy rainstorms across the state. And so that added this whole other layer of damage, just kind of tore out some of those dead trees. A ton was pushed into the campground and reservoir up there and, you know, flooded homes. So the community in the forest is having kind of these multiple layers of disasters happening that they're having to recover from, and in some ways it's maybe like foreshadowing what could be happening in parts of the state that are burning right now or have burned this summer, because flash floods after fires are pretty common here.
So you talk to wildland fire experts, and things have been changing, right? Of course, climate change, drought. So tell me a bit about that.
So in Pine Valley, it's primarily ponderosa forests, and, you know, ponderosa forests evolved with fire. Brad Washa, professor of wildland fire science at Utah State, told me that most of Utah is a fire-dependent ecosystem. They developed alongside fire. A few things have been happening over the past century. One, ways that, you know, indigenous people managed and lived with forests for centuries haven't been happening. We had suppression policies, so, you know, right when fires happen, we would put them out right away. So maybe some of the undergrowth in these ponderosa forests that would typically get burnt in these more frequent fires historically started building up. And Brad Washa, this professor, described it as sort of like these ladder fuels. So the fires are reaching higher up into the ponderosas. And once a fire reaches high up in the ponderosa tree, it can cause more damage. You know, the bark of these trees is thick. They can sustain kind of lower level fires, but once it consumes the whole tree, it's much harder for them to survive. So that's happening alongside, as you mentioned, climate change, which is leading to drought. So we're having drier soils, this extreme heat, which is also creating these intense wind events. So the fires are also just becoming more extreme, an environment that also has been managed in a way that's just kind of leading to these, causing this dangerous fire situation as well.
I just want to read this line from your story. Scientists at Utah State University found that hotter summer temperatures will likely cause a 160% increase in area burned across the state by 2050.
Yeah. I mean, that was a recent study that came out earlier this year, also from Utah State University scientists. So with climate change and just temperature markers, we're seeing likely more and more of Utah will experience wildfire.
So what are the experts you talk to, what are they prescribing? What are they saying should happen to try to counteract this?
Yeah, Utah State, they are saying, you know, that prescribed burns, forest thinning, more active forest management in some places can help. Also just, you know, a lot of wildfires in Utah and across the country are human caused. And so emphasis also on how to live in the wildland urban interface in a responsible way. And part of that is making your home more fire resilient. So that may be creating defensible space around your home, removing wood chips, you know, not having a wood pile near your house, screening out vents. And then also some people are looking at, you know, particularly in Pine Valley, this is an active conversation right now as people are rebuilding their homes that burnt down, how to build homes from the start to be more fire resilient, things like metal roofs, using like fiber cement or concrete or other non-combustible materials. Things like that are ways that like individuals can help if you're living in the wildland urban interface.
I do know from your story that the Forest Service did try before the Forsyth fire, right? They cut a, or thinned a break, I guess, near the town. That didn't work in this case.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they said that fuel break, so basically they did do some thinning and prescribed burns in the forest and created this fuel break around the town. And they think it helped slow the growth of the fire in those places, but it obviously didn't stop it. And I mean, that's something I heard on other fires that I have covered in Utah over the past year too. And so I do think this is an interesting question to look at more deeply going forward is how effective, you know, this is sort of the policy that's been adopted, how effective is it, especially in this time of climate change when we're having these more extreme fires, and is there anything else that we can be doing, or is this just our reality now? So there are definitely some questions I plan to dig into more deeply this year.
I guess you can Google FireWise, you know, FireWise landscaping, FireWise construction, to if you're planning on being in a kind of a wildland urban interface.
That's a great tool. And you know, some places, I mean Pine Valley specifically, and I think other communities as well, the local fire department is offering consultations to help homeowners think of ways to make their landscaping and their house more resilient in fires. So that's a potential resource for people.
I don't know if you I think you didn't talk to anybody about this specifically for this story, but you know, one proposal that you hear sometimes is greater government restrictions preventing people from even building in some of these areas.
Yeah, I mean, that is not something I've covered much, but I mean, in Utah, you know, a bill passed that will start taxing some people that live in these areas if they, and you can, you know, if you take certain measures, I believe that can be minimized, or, you know, there's certain incentives to create this defensible space or firewise landscaping like we were talking about. But the state's definitely looking into how do we sort of like at least shore up funds to keep fighting these fires. And, you know, it's causing difficulty for people who live in these places too with insurance companies and things like that. So it's an ongoing discussion for sure.
We're talking with Brooke Larson. We have a couple minutes here in this segment. Love to talk about this story. The best defense against Utah's extreme heat might be a tree. So the Washington County Water Conservancy District is offering a tree bait. So this is trees to counteract the heat, right?
Yeah. So, you know, Washington County, I think more and more has been in the news for its landscape conversion program, incentivizing people to remove their lawns and replace it with water-wise landscaping. And so now people that participate in that program will get additional incentives for each tree they plant. So this tree bait is an additional $100 for each qualifying tree planted.
I love this. The Water District has its top 10 shady characters list. I guess these are the right trees to plant in the desert environment.
Yeah. Washington County Water Conservancy District loves their kind of their puns, and they've got great marketing. So yeah, they have their shady characters, and you can look online to find that. There's a link to it in our story. Those are some of the trees that if you plant those are some of the qualifying ones. There are certain ones that they will not give you an incentive for to plant, so it's important to check that out.
I just want to mention the top three: Arizona velvet mesquite, blue ghost eucalyptus, and the chaste tree are their top three. You can go to Brooke's story and find that list. We've been talking with Brooke Larson, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for telling us about these stories.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
So as we head toward a break, coming back from the break, we'll be talking about this story. A sculptor wants his grand Utah arch to unify Americans. The surprised neighborhood wants to stop it. We'll be talking with State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, who bring in next State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
So here's the headline. A sculptor wants his grand Utah arch to unify Americans. The surprised neighborhood wants to stop it. So tell us first about the sculptor. Who is it?
His name is Saban Howard. He actually is... His best known work is the National World War I Memorial in Washington, D.C. It was completed in 2024. And he, his next big project is slated to be here in Utah.
Why did he choose Utah?
So essentially, you know, he told me that there are a few reasons he chose Utah. He said as he was wrapping up the World War I project, he was kind of driving around the country looking for a place to build a monument, to work on a monument like this. He said at this ceremony in 2024 where they lit up the National World War I Memorial, he ended up sitting next to Utah's U.S. Senator Mike Lee. And Mike Lee told him to check out Utah. And he said that pretty soon after, he was on a plane to Utah, visited Temple Square, and there he decided, you know, he said he called his wife and said, this is the place, without realizing that that had been said by Brigham Young a century and a half or so before. And then he said he and his wife sold their house and packed up all of their stuff and got in a Sprinter van and moved to Utah. That was in 2025. And some of the reasons he told me that Utah appealed to him was he said there was a lot of bureaucracy that he had to get through to build his World War I memorial and really to build any sort of monument anywhere in the country. And he said that was not as present or not as big of a problem here in Utah, and that he felt the values that his monument, his arch conveys, line up with the political values of Utah, or maybe Utah's leadership.
So I'm looking at a photo of a smaller scale model of this. It's essentially an arch. There are figures to the left, figures to the right, figures on top of the arch. Maybe you could explain this a little better for our audience.
Yeah, so this arch, has sculpted figures on all sides of it. It's an archway that, you know, folks would walk through. It's supposed to be placed in a park, an empty plot of land, next to the Capitol. It depicts a number of scenes, Sabin Howard's interpretation of scenes from U.S. history. So it shows, you know, his depiction of the birth of the country, with soldiers from the Revolutionary War. It shows the signing of the Declaration of Independence. There are numerous depictions of Lady Liberty on the arch. On another side, it shows essentially what is supposed to be the 20th century. It shows a troop from World War I, other troops from wars fought in the last century. But some of the most controversial portions of the arch are on the two sides of it. This one is not so controversial, but it shows scenes from the Civil War. But on the other, there is there's an enslaved black man in chains, and he has Lady Liberty pulling them off. And then there is a Native American warrior and his son, who are, you know, according to his Sabin Howard's description, quote, "they block the portal to the west." And then he writes in his description, "the scene is tense. A violent fight is imminent as cultures collide." And the warrior is holding a tomahawk in the air as he faces the settler.
Now, Howard says he used Native American models for this and consulted with those, I guess, a couple of Native Americans. Some are saying that wasn't sufficient.
Yeah, so, you know, he said that when he was asked, a lot of the opposition to this is coming from the folks in the local neighborhood. And so when he was asked at a meeting with them about, you know, how he made sure that his depiction of this Native American man and his son was appropriate and accurate, he said, quote, "I went and got an Iroquois." And so, you know, what is known sometimes, the tribe that's sometimes known as the Iroquois, by, you know, primarily white Americans, is called the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. So we actually reached out to them to get their thoughts on the depiction. And they thought it perpetuated violent stereotypes about Native Americans in the country, and that really the clothing and the tomahawk were not historically accurate. We also spoke to Alexandra Greenwald, who's an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Utah, and who works with the Natural History Museum of Utah on its displays about Utah's tribal nations. And she said that's when just talking to, you know, a couple of Native American individuals about their opinions on portrayal is not the proper way to do consultation for a large-scale public display like this.
Is Howard open at all to making any changes to the monument?
From my conversations with him, the monument is pretty final in the ways that it's been sculpted and designed. And, you know, he said that he's frustrated with these kinds of conversations and called them silly because he felt that the point of the sculpture is not these depictions. He said the point of the sculpture, he told me that he's kind of sick of these negative conversations about culture in the U.S. and he wanted something that's positive, that builds unity, and wants people to look at it like that. So he's not really, he was pretty dismissive of these conversations and said that he felt that he did what he could do to include the diverse array of Americans in his sculpture.
So where is this slated to go? What location?
So it's on the west side of the Utah Capitol. There's a little park there just across the street from the Capitol. It's state-owned land. And, you know, there's tall trees that surround. And it's supposed to go right in the center of that park.
So some of the residents there are objecting. What are their objections?
Right. There are, you know, according to the state representative who represents the area around the Capitol, she said that she's not gotten any good feedback, and it's all been negative from the area residents. And so she surveyed all of them. And then at neighborhood council meetings, community council meetings, they've attended and expressed their opinion. Sabin Howard attended one of those meetings. And some of the things that people have been saying in the survey and at those meetings is, one, they use that park. People use that park to be active, to take their dogs on walks, to just get outside. And they're not very happy about the arch taking up some of that green space and the likelihood that a lot of those tall old trees will be cut down for the project. They also are not happy about just the aesthetic of the arch. They feel that it doesn't match with the culture of their neighborhood. The Capitol Hill Marmalade area has some of the oldest homes in the state. They feel that this does not honor that. And they have raised questions about, you know, the cultural sensitivities with the arch, some of the problems that they see. When I was talking to Representative Jennifer Daly Provo, who represents that area, she said that a lot of the residents she's talked to see the arch as, quote, downright racist.
Hmm. Now, Representative Daly Provo is on the Capital Preservation Board, and apparently it was unanimous vote in favor, right? How does she explain that?
Yeah, so she has been pretty frustrated with the process, she said, of approving the arch. She said she didn't realize when she voted then that that was the final approval for the arch. She said that she thought it was a vote to consider the arch in the future. But she said that, you know, she has felt that the board could have been more transparent with the community and the public about what it was doing and that this conversation was even happening and included more public opinion. I went to the meeting where that arch was approved. That was in May. And there was no public comment period for people to offer their opinion on it. And when the arch was brought up, you know, at that point, Sabin Howard had finished designing the arch, and most of the discussions around the arch and what monument might be added to the Capitol had happened in closed meetings of a separate selection committee. And so by the time it got to a vote of the board, it was almost already a done deal.
By the way, what kinds of people are on the Capitol Preservation Board? It's elected officials?
Yeah, elected officials, and it's Utah's top elected officials. Mm-hmm. So that particular meeting was chaired by Governor Spencer Cox. You also had Senate President Stuart Adams, House Speaker Mike Schultz, Attorney General Derrick Brown is on the board, State Treasurer Marlo Oakes. You've got some other Republican lawmakers. And then there are a couple of Democratic lawmakers, including Representative Daley Profo, and then Salt Lake City Senator Jen Plum. And so really, you know, it's Utah's most influential leaders are on that board.
So I guess the Capitol Preservation Board is saying that the final vote has been taken. This is going forward. Any recourse for these residents?
You know, that's really unclear. The residents said that they are writing a complaint letter to the board that they will be submitting. And they actually, you know, went to Attorney General Derrick Brown asking him to look into a potential violation of the Open and Public Meetings Act by the Capitol Preservation Board. He declined. And so it seems like that letter may be one of the only things it can do is just to, you know, for the community to express their opinion. But I know they're looking at what other options they may have. And so we'll see how they end up taking this on. But Representative Daley Provo told me that she plans to share the survey results with other board members in its next meeting in September.
Now, one interesting little tidbit here, the Capitol Preservation Board, I guess, voted in the past that they're only going to authorize one big monument per century, and I guess this is it for this century?
Yeah, this is it for, you know, officially 2027. So by that timeline, Utah won't be able to add another large monument to the Capitol until, or vote won't be able to approve adding a large monument to the Capitol until 2127. But there are other monuments that have shorter time frames, like medium commemorative elements and small commemorative elements. But yeah, this is the last large one for the next century, unless for some reason future state leaders decide to change the rules.
All right, we'll see how this one goes. Emily Anderson Stern, Statewatch reporter, has been telling us about this. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, Tom.
We're going to head toward another break, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, here's the headline. Davis County formally rebukes a commissioner over claims of egregious workplace behavior. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad following this brief break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
So here's the headline we want to go to next. Davis County formally rebukes a commissioner over claims of egregious workplace behavior. Tony, does Davis County have, I guess, the format, three commissioners that a lot of counties have?
Yeah, I looked it up. One of the 21, I believe, counties that still has the three commissioner system.
Yeah, so this is pretty unusual. The other commissioners were, I guess, involved in this, looking into their fellow commissioner, John Crofts. So what is he accused of doing?
Well, so this flowed from about a five-month-long investigation that started in November at the behest of the county to look into these allegations that were surfacing amongst county employees of this sort of behavior on Mr. Croft's part. An independent law firm hired by the county ended up interviewing 24 different witnesses, including Mr. Crofts himself. And as per the motion to censure passed on Tuesday, one of his fellow commissioners, Lorene Kamalu, said essentially these were uniform complaints of egregious and unacceptable workplace behavior. County employees felt he was sort of exercising these patterns of political favoritism, interviewing them on their specific sort of affiliations and voting choices, and then those employees said that they felt that they were then retaliated against. There were allegations of LGBTQ plus discrimination, accusations of that Mr. Crofts would purportedly bring up of sort of political and personal misconduct. And judging from this letter of censure that was passed by Mr. Crofts' colleagues, Bob J. Stevenson and Lorene Kamalu, this represented a sort of a liability, a sense of liability on the county's part, and was a move to kind of protect county employees and remaining staff. In addition to sort of a formal censure that was part of the motion, Mr. Crofts has been removed from any sort of supervisory role over county employees, and then the commission has sort of accelerated a kind of a rotation system that they have to fill the position of chair, and Mr. Crofts has now been rotated out of that chair position, and Bob Stevenson, who was vice chair, is now the chairman. And then again, under this sort of pretty standard system, when you've got a three-member commission, individual commissioners sort of allocated, supervisory duties or purview over specific aspects of county government, and Mr. Crofts has now been removed from any purview over county facilities, golf courses, public works, and human resources, and also he had been in a role of advising the county on senior services, and that will no longer be the case.
There were some kind of bizarre allegations, or allegations of his bizarre behavior. Mr. Crofts saying he could control the weather, and he was working for Mossad.
Yeah, there were those kind of claims, he had purportedly said these things to individual county employees. To be very clear, Mr. Crofts has questioned the authenticity or questioned the accuracy of this investigative finding. He's claimed variously that it's riddled with inaccuracies or exaggerations and omissions, including at Tuesday's meeting, has sort of claimed there were political motives behind this. Mr. Crofts emerged as one of the critics, if you will, of the county's approach to its most recent budget, including a property tax increase, and he has claimed in various forums that this was sort of this brought him under a critical eye, if you will, of county employees and elected officials, and had sort of motivated as part of his argument that the investigation was sort of frivolous and costly and maybe politically motivated. The only real, sort of major claim that was brought up in this letter of censure and emerged from the investigative report that he, direct addressly, he pretty much sidestepped, at least at Tuesday's meeting, any of the, sort of central allegations that were brought up in that investigative report. But he did seek to refute that he was biased against LGBTQ. He devoted part of his remarks on Tuesday to seeking to kind of turn that aside and saying that he did not have that bias.
Mr. Krops also accused the county, the offices there, of having a toxic culture of gossip. I guess implied he was a victim of that.
Yeah, there seemed to be a pretty significant undercurrent of, Mr. Krops kind of characterizing county politics as he has found them since he was elected. He is the newest member on the commission. I think was voted in and or came to office in 2025, and had sort of it was part of his basis for kind of decrying the investigation's findings and claiming that it was politically motivated.
So he won't face voters again for another couple of years, 4-year terms, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. In the meantime, I think his fellow commissioner is running for state senate.
Yeah, that's right.
Bob Stevenson.
Bob Stevenson has made it through, I believe, the Republican primary and will be seeking office this November.
Yeah. Well, Tony, we have time to take a look at another story that I found quite fascinating, kind of an example of things that are going around Utah, disputes over changes to how property is managed. And so here's the headline: dispute over open space in Salt Lake City sparks a neighborhood standoff. So where are we talking about here?
So this is a neighborhood in what's technically Highland Park of Salt Lake City, fully within Salt Lake City boundaries, by the way. This would be kind of just south of Interstate 80 and Sugar House Park. And the piece of property in question is owned by South Salt Lake and was, in fact, a piece of Sugar House Park back in the day before Interstate 80 sort of peeled it off from the expanse of that park to the north. This is involves about 35 homeowners whose homes run along Parkway Avenue, just to the south of this long sort of thin piece of ground that South Salt Lake owns. They've just sort of assumed over the last 46 years since South Salt Lake has owned it that it abuts their backyards. It's been sort of an open boundary. They've felt at ease at sort of accessing the green space and mow it occasionally, and over the years have developed garden beds and groves of trees just along that sort of edge next to their backyards. And I have to say I share your kind of fascination with this, and that it touches on some of these broader issues about, how we're, looking at open space as the county's population continues to grow, and the wildfire concern. So South Salt Lake, starting in April, has been warning these residents that it needs to treat this piece of property differently now. It's an important piece of city infrastructure, according to South Salt Lake, and the city is pursuing putting up a boundary fence around. It's about, depending on how you carve it up, at about an 8-acre space, and they're setting in motion a timeline where that will ultimately be fenced. And this, of course, has raised some concerns among the residents in that, yes, indeed, they would be losing open access to this, like, sort of vacant lot behind their homes. But they're also much more seriously worried about the wildfire risk. Their experience is that South Salt Lake, as essentially a private landowner in Salt Lake City that is sort of next door to them, has not done enough of a job in keeping the ground mowed to reduce wildfire risk. And so they've taken taken advantage of their access to kind of mow a sort of a strip between their homes and the taller grass on the property. And with this fence, they're fearing that they would lose that ability to sort of knock down the fire risk immediately next to their homes. And you know, it would indeed be, were the grass kept long there, it would indeed be a fire risk being sort of proximal to, Interstate 80. Another undercurrent here is that as far as the residents are concerned, that they haven't really gotten a lot of response from South Salt Lake. They feel like they've approached in a variety of ways and, in fact, involved their Salt Lake City Council member, Sarah Young, at one point to kind of come and testify at a South Salt Lake Council hearing. I believe it was a budget meeting. It was a recent hearing that's been since April. And they feel like they've just sort of received a cold shoulder from the city, and they haven't really gotten the kind of input or response that they wanted as they're trying to work through this.
So tell me about this standoff. This was fascinating. The tension's been rising, right? And then so earlier this week, I think it was South Salt Lake City crews arrived to work on the land, and they were confronted by residents.
Yeah, well, South Salt Lake had in its sort of doorknob hangers and letters and warnings and that sort of a thing had set a July 1 deadline for residents to sort of remove whatever they had from the property, that and after that date it was going to be considered abandoned and could be pulled off the property without further notice, according to South Salt Lake. So the very next business day was that Monday, July 6th, and starting at about 6:30, residents were lined up on lawn chairs on the sidewalk in front of the only access road to this piece of property, which is at Parkway Avenue and 13th East. And sure enough, city crews did turn out that day at about, about an hour and a half after they had amassed at this particular corner. There, depending on how you view it, it was a little bit of a standoff. Residents weren't really willing to grant the crews access to the property without kind of knowing what was going to happen. At some point, somebody called Salt Lake City Police Department, and a couple of officers came out, and, you know, there was a period of, you know, maybe 80, 90 minutes of sort of, negotiations between, an exchange of information through the officers as to what exactly was going to happen that day. There, a little delegation of the residents kind of toured the site with a police officer and the sort of crew supervisor, and they got a sense of what work was going to be done, and then it did diffuse, and it's a very sort of poignant moment where the residents handed out their sort of extra donuts and that sort of thing to the crew workers. Their dispute obviously wasn't with these public works officials who had turned out, but rather with the city. But yeah, it was a very interesting sort of scene to watch.
Yeah, it sounded like quite the scene. So South Salt Lake does own this land. I guess they'll proceed with their plans, I guess.
Yeah, they're being very I don't think there's a specific timeline. There's one particular resident who'd lived there for upwards of 50 years, who's got some pretty well-established kind of fruit trees and a garden in that area. There's some sort of, more substantial kind of playground equipment that some residents have put up and that sort of thing. The residents are sort of wary of the day when South Salt Lake may come in and sort of scrape all that off the property. There's not really a specific timeline for that at this point, but South Salt Lake has made it clear that it's going to happen at one point. They've got a sort of right of way between the surveyed between the backyards and the property where they're going to run this fence. So we don't have a specific D-Day as as such, but there have been some. The property came to South Salt Lake in 1980 under some interesting conditions that have involved the Sugar House Park Authority, Salt Lake County, and Salt Lake City. And my understanding is that there has been some sort of legal musings, if you will, about how that agreement might or might not affect South Salt Lake's ownership right now. That doesn't seem to be going anywhere based on my reporting. And again, South Salt Lake is really viewing this as an important piece of its kind of city infrastructure, even though it's not part of South Salt Lake city limits. It does serve some utility purposes at this point. There's a couple of underground tanks on one of the pieces of the property. And so it is adamant that, you know, it's going to have to protect this, you know, put up a fence to sort of limit access. And that day will come.
Well, Tony Simmer has been talking to us about these stories. Tony, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. Let's go first to Brooke Larson. Brooke, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, to stick on the fire recovery theme, Julie Jagg had a great story out today on the Eagle Point recovery, what that ski area is looking like as the Cottonwood fire calms down. So that's a very immediate look at what that recovery is going to look like.
SLTrib.com for that one. Thanks, Brooke. Emily Anderson Stern, what's your underplayed story?
Yeah, it's one from my colleague Megan Vanta. There was a city council member in Centerville who displays a pride flag on her desk. And after complaints from residents, the state auditor looked into it to see if it violated the state's pride flag ban in government spaces. And she determined that no, individual elected officials are able to display pride flags under the First Amendment.
All right. You can check that out at SLTrib.com as well. Tony Semmerad, what's your underplayed story?
Well, mine is one from our colleague Jose Davila IV, and it's sort of a yes, it's true story. The widespread ban on personal fireworks over the July 4th weekend appeared to have the effect of limiting new wildfire starts, but it also contributed to some of the lowest air pollution levels we have seen on an Independence Day in the history of kind of monitoring data. You know, this has been a phenomenon every July 4th that I've lived here where the air quality gets significantly worse, and it's these tiny airborne particles that are not especially good when you breathe them in. And it turns out that, yes, the data suggests that fireworks are a big contributor on July 4th.
All right. Check that out at SLTrib.com as well. Well, you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern has been with us. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And reporter Tony Semmerad has been with us. Thanks, Tony.
Hey, thank you, too.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Behind the Headlines. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.